Welcome to Frankly Speaking on the TurfNet Radio Network. Here's your host, Dr. Frank Rossi.
Thank you and welcome to Frankly Speaking. I'm Dr. Frank Rossi, professor of horticulture at Cornell University and proud member of the TurfNet Radio Network. Frankly Speaking is that place where we're getting more and more people interested in listening to conversations about topics that continue to persist in the turf grass industry. And we try to get, I always try to get, because I like doing it, chatting to, with some people who are very thoughtful about the subject. And we've done it with a variety of topics on this show over the first couple of years. And one of the ones I've been persistent about, particularly because much of, I think, the Northeast is not as acutely concerned, unless there's a drought in place, is that the issue with water. And I think the growing concern that we as a nation and as a world think about the way we use potable water is going to be increasingly important for the managing of our turf grass systems. And I like to think about water use for golf courses and sports fields and lawns, and especially in arid environments, the importance of irrigating or hydrating is the word I like, hydrating that urban environment, and the importance of water for the just the ecosystem services, the services that the turf can provide to the human population, especially in urban areas, and even more so, I think, in those dry areas where the heat that radiates off the impervious surface creates enormous amounts of problems. So that's a big 30,000-foot view look at it, right? And then there's the way we think about turf, you know, water use in turf for the things that we get paid to do on turf, golf course superintendents and sports field managers paid for traction and safety, golf course superintendents paid for aesthetic value, playability, the things that the golfers demand from the playing surface, same with athletes in a professional situation. And so the demands that are placed on turf grass managers that then impact their decisions to water is a little bit about what we're going to explore today. But we're going to come at it with Professor Ben Worley at Texas A&M University, professor of turf grass science and ecology down in College Station. And Ben joins us, I believe, from College Station on the program here. Ben, welcome to the program. You just heard me bloviate for a minute, as I've been told I do on this program, bloviate a little bit about water. And we're going to wander into your work with water. Welcome to the program. What's going on in Texas these days?
Well, hello, Frank. It's certainly my pleasure to be on your podcast today. Ironically enough, it's raining today in College Station.
Of course.
But, yeah, the water certainly is a subject that I'm passionate about, and I look forward to having a conversation with you today about it.
Great. So let's get started with, how is it you wandered into the study of consumptive water use and deficit irrigation in turf from Eastern Ohio, you tell me, not far from Canton, Akron, or just south, or where? LeBron James territory, yes?
That's right. That's right. So I grew up in a town called New Philadelphia, Ohio, and really my only interest and knowledge of turf growing up was the fact that I had to mow my dad's yard, and starting in high school, got an opportunity to, guess I did a good enough job that some neighbors took notice and got a few lawns down the road, and next thing you know, I'm mowing two or three lawns and really started to develop an appreciation for it. When I got into high school, there was a fellow at our church that was a golf course owner at Zora Village Golf Club, which is just south of Canton. Ernie Frank was his name, and Ernie hired me on as a summer worker, and I was hooked. I mean, I just, you know, I was, had always had a passion for the outdoors and really working with my hands, and really that experience hooked me into golf, and what a great experience. Getting up early in the mornings, going out, mowing fairways, mowing greens, cutting cups. Yeah. And that was really my first experience in turf. And that
was enough to get you into the Ohio State University. The question is, and I'll only do this a few more times, did you play golf at the Ohio State University, or were you just a student at the Ohio State University?
I played golf, but I wasn't good enough to be on the golf team. I did spend much of the time that I wasn't in class there as a student. I worked at the campus course there with Gary Razor, and that was really a great experience that he gave a lot of the students. And I would encourage Turf students today to really take advantage of those opportunities to work a few hours here and there in the midst of their studies, and it really makes that learning so much more relevant. So ended up getting my undergrad there in turfgrass science, and at the time, again, had no aspirations of going on for a master's, let alone PhD.
Did you work with Dave Gardner at Ohio State?
I actually, my undergraduate was under Dr. Carl Vandenberger.
Okay.
And ended up getting a job at a local country club for about a year and a half, working as an assistant. And pretty soon thereafter, had an opportunity to come back and work with Dr. David Gardner. I was his first graduate student at Ohio State. And what a great opportunity to kind of start to get exposed to the whole research side of things.
Yeah. Yeah, I just saw Dave. I was at the 50th OTF just last week. I don't even know anymore, but I think it was just last week that I was there at the 50th anniversary and got to spend some time with David, one of my all-time favorite turf grass scientists, trained under Bruce Branham, a pal of mine from way back. And so I know you're well trained coming out of there. So you work with Gardner for your master's. And then to NC State with Tom Ruffey?
That's right. I was pursuing a PhD at that point because I realized I really enjoyed teaching students. And some of the experience that I had prior to graduate school doing the master's degree really helped a lot in working with students, draw from some relevant experiences. And so in pursuing graduate school, I was thought it would help me to get some warm season experience, so ended up getting an assistantship at NC State with Tom Ruffey and Dan Bowman.
Oh boy, and, two smart guys.
And that was a great experience. Really took me into very smart guys. Took me into a very new world for me, where nutrient management was such a big issue in the Carolinas, and with the coastal issues and eutrophication, and of course turf tending to get a bad rap at times. Heavily centered research on how do we best minimize environmental impacts and really do the best job we can managing our turf from a fertility standpoint. So I was there for my PhD. And still very little research or background in water even up to that point, and graduated in 2008, and were absolutely no faculty jobs at the time. So I had an opportunity to go to University of Florida for a postdoc degree, and I was able to work on a project that was funded by the Southwest Florida Water Management District.
Okay.
And it was really centered on really trying to get a grasp on how much water do grasses need in Florida. It was a very controversial issue. There's a lot of press, a lot of publicity on what grasses are acceptable for the landscape and for turf situations and which aren't, which are water hogs, which are water guzzlers. So this was a very important project from a public standpoint, but also from a scientific standpoint. There just weren't a lot of data for that part of the country in terms of really recognizing what the water requirements are for some of these species we're managing.
Well, and even further than that, I mean, I think, and one of the things that I see now, of course I prepare for these things, Ben, these conversations, by trying to sort of read some of your most recent work. And I hear you talking about, now you've made the shift to water at Florida, in a very particular time where you needed foundational measurements or just baseline measures for, heck, how much water do we use? How much water do grasses use? And now I'm looking at this evaluation of urban landscape water use work that you did for the Texas Water Council. And it's the same idea of, you know, how much water are we using? How much land are we irrigating? How much water do those grasses use? When you look at the scale that we do in turf, Ben, that's the thing that gets really fascinating for me quickly, which is, yeah, you're studying like, okay, I only use a few hundred gallons or a few hundred thousand gallons. But then you look at the scale of the amount of turf we have, particularly in places like Florida and Texas, right? And that's the easy motivation for the easy motivation for why we have to be studying this. So what did you do? So how did it turn out in Florida? Well, it got you the job at Texas, huh?
Well, it's really interesting because when I moved to Florida, you know, I was going in and I'm thinking, here's a state that gets so much rainfall in the summertime. Why are we studying water down here? And as it turns out, it's, you know, what really opened my eyes was it's not always an issue with drought. It really centers a lot around population growth and where are the population centers and what are the available water supplies and who gets them. So, and really from the standpoint of not even for the turf manager, but even more so for the folks that are writing the permits for drilling, for allocating water for new developments, for new golf courses. They need to know specifically how much water is needed and it needs to be justified. So, this really goes to the turf manager, but it also goes to agencies that are allowing water withdrawal permits, et cetera. So some very interesting research. And what we had at the time was we had some work out of the Southwest, a good deal of work out of the Southwest, but very little out of the Southeast. And as we know, regional, there are some regional variations in water use. And so our work, you know, in a nutshell, was basically demonstrated that over about a 3-year period, we found that the, you know, in looking at some warm season grasses, Zoysia Bermuda grass, St. Augustine grass, and Bahia grass, what we were doing was we actually measuring water use on about every 2-week basis through the growing season and comparing that to reference ET to develop crop coefficients. Right. And what became very interesting about that was that on about 36 total measurement dates over those 3 years, we did not see a difference in water use between Bermuda, Zoysia, and St. Augustine grass, meaning they use the same amount of water under field capacity conditions.
Under well-watered conditions.
That's right. So, I mean, this...
Right. Now, listen, wait, because you're going, okay, see, this is what happens. See, I get you guys who are like, well, I don't know if I have anything to say when before you get on the podcast, and then we start, and I can't shut you up because it's my show, and I got to talk a little bit, too. So
go for it, Frank.
So listen, we got to go to, before we go to a message from our sponsors, Ben, listen, so I want to wrap up this work in Florida a little bit. I want to try to summarize it. Reflect it back at you, and then you give me a yay or nay, that's the right thing, because I want to transition to that sort of next level of work when you got to Texas A&M. But let's wrap up the Florida work. So I've seen, of course, this work because it gets touted because Florida has had some droughts, meteorological droughts, where it's been dry for periods of time. I've been traveling into Florida over the last several years. And I tell you, water is not going to be less of an issue as time goes on. So you provided this foundational work. Has it? What do you think has come of it all these years later? Right, you're 10 years removed from there now, almost.
About six or seven years.
All right, so years. Tie a bow on what happened. What was the impact of your work? That big project that you did down there, what was the impact of that, into the turf industry in Florida?
Well, I think from the funder's standpoint, they got some information that's going to help them to make more educated decisions on permitting for various types of turf grass species and different types of situations. So, but from a turf grass manager standpoint, I think what you see with the data that we came out of in that project is that it allows a superintendent or an athletic field manager, lawn care, really to really give prescribed amounts of irrigation to the plant that are meeting the maximal water requirement for that plant throughout the season, not overwatering, not underwatering. And that's really a foundational starting point when we think about irrigation management. When we have enough water to work with, we certainly want to water to an ideal standpoint if we can, so we can get the maximal function out of that plant.
Well, we're going to talk about that in a second, young man. When we come back, I am going to challenge that point in particular about whether we should keep plants in a well-watered condition. I'm joined today by Professor Ben Worley at Texas A&M University. I'm Frank Rossi. You're listening to Frankly Speaking on the TurfNet Radio Network. We'll be back.
Golf course superintendents all agree. Traditional core aeration is time-consuming, labor-intensive, and unpopular with golfers. Dryject is a revolutionary service that relieves compaction, increases water infiltration, improves gas exchange, and amends your root zone all at the same time, leaving the turf surface smooth and immediately playable. Best of all, an independent Dryject service professional does it for you, there and gone before you know it. Dryject, the only process in the world that aerates, top dresses, and amends in one pass. Visit dryject.com to locate your nearest Dryject service center.
Okay, we're back on Frankly Speaking. I'm Frank Rossi at Cornell University, the TurfNet Radio Network. Joined today, Professor Ben Worley from Texas A&M University, the home of Johnny Manziel. Doesn't it make you proud? He ultimately came to the great state of Ohio to be one of the sort of spin the carousel of quarterbacks that those lowly Cleveland Browns have had. Before we get back into water, where does your allegiance lie?
Well, Frank, I'm sorry that you had to bring that up. I forget how many quarterbacks the Browns have had in the last 15 years. I think it's been about 30 quarterbacks. But college football-wise, Texas A&M pays me, so I'm an Aggie. But I have a pretty strong interest in the Ohio State Buckeyes, too.
Oh, you do? Okay. So, and I think they're going to be playing in some big games soon, but we're not going to wander into that area at all, because the question you left us with, Ben, that I want to chat for a second before we get into some of your work, is the idea of, you know, just the context with which you studied that the methodology for studying consumptive water use is simply to make sure that water isn't limiting and to watch the plant, see how much water the plant uses. And that is also assuming, I mean, that's the sort of baseline physiological aspect. But when you work back, I think what we've learned, and I think what you're going to tell me you've learned, is that some water deficit stress or water stress can actually make the plant, by not definition, healthier, but maybe more resilient. So if I started out, Ben, our conversation into your work by first challenging that argument, isn't that the basis of why we, other than we want to save water, isn't that the basis of why we use terms like deficit irrigation and maximum allowable deficit?
Well, I would argue that, you know, probably the healthiest plant is the plant that's watered to its maximal water requirement. Now, with that said, it's still very important that we're not overwatering turf. If we get past that maximal water use point, then we start to run into situations where we have too wet of a root zone, not enough oxygen in the root zone, et cetera.
Right. But when you've got a golf course fairway, okay. When you got a golf course fairway, all right, the undulations everywhere, right? And what are the golf superintendents being pushed around on these days? Firm and fast, right? So
that's right.
I hear from more of the best golf superintendents on a regular basis, many of which I know are listening to this program in one way, shape, or form. And what they'll tell you is if their better golfers don't see brown turf somewhere, they're complaining about the management of the golf course from a playability perspective. And we would argue too, Ben, right, that you know – that it's hard to water those areas uniformly, that there is a certain amount of stress, and that is the goal of what we're doing. And how do you relate sort of that it's well-watered work with how we know these guys actually manage and what deficit irrigation is, right?
Well, there's no doubt that I think the industry, and from a playability standpoint now, I think if you get into a playability standpoint, there's no question what you're saying is true. But from a plant health standpoint, I mean, I think, we could have a discussion on that. We'd have another podcast on that. But as our industry is, you know, one of the biggest issues we're faced with right now, or arguably the greatest issue, is water.
Right.
And I think whether it's enhancing playability or not, I think most superintendents are being forced with having to go firm and fast, and maybe limiting the amount of area on their course that's irrigated, and really being a better conservationist with regard to water.
So then it's a given, right? I mean, whether the climate's going to do it to us, because of the extreme conditions we're going to be under, or the pressures of society are going to put on us for either limiting in real or limiting by perception, how we're going to use water in golf, or it's just you can't afford it or you don't have access to it. For whatever reason, we have to condition and select and manage turf under the most drought stress conditions we can keep it. Wouldn't you say? Isn't that partly the goal, that we should strive to tailor our management to maximize drought stress tolerance?
I would agree with that, Frank. I mean, I think, and from the superintendents I meet, I mean, I think the majority of them have that goal in mind. You know, they're very conscious of water management. They're very conscious of player expectations, and you're right. It's when you dial it in, that's usually where you end up, is on that, maybe not on the edge, but close to it in many situations.
Let me bug you again on this. So you brought a good point, because I do think superintendents are aware of this and are striving to do it, and I think what's driving it in some ways is, especially if they're good golfers, that's what they want. But they're being held accountable in some ways by their best golfers for allowing this to occur, within a degree, right? Within a degree. So they're motivated to do it. Now, you have spent a part of your career studying a single component and the energy dynamics of the Penman-Monteith ET equation, right? That's a data point. Now we're seeing the advent of soil sensors, and there's been some foundational work, and I think more suggestion than real data lately, that sensors are likely going to play a part soon in the way we manage water on the turf. What has been your experience? Because we are relying on superintendents to make these management decisions on water, and yet you and I know a lot of the trouble I see on golf courses is related to the way they manage their water. Mm-hmm. So where are you at with, what I'm shooting my mouth off here about data management and overwatering, mm-hmm. and using more mm-hmm. data to make decisions?
Well, I think some of the best examples I've seen of this are, I don't want to prop up any particular golf course, but the crew up at TPC Four Seasons, they hosted the Byron Nelson. Do an outstanding job of kind of being cutting edge in this. They, twice a day they'll go across their greens with TDR probes on a grid-like pattern and basically walk section by section, test and compare that to a wilting threshold that they're aware of, and mm-hmm. water accordingly. And so this precision application of water that's only in response to soil moisture data is definitely the way forward, and they've been hugely successful because of that. They have a lot more confidence going into the weekends, mm-hmm. knowing where those greens are at, where they're right. expecting them to be based on forecasted reference ET.
All right.
And so, in my right. opinion, soil moisture sensors have value, but the best example I've seen are these handheld meters not necessarily the ones that you might bury, and in the, because the question always comes back, well, where do I bury this? Do I, and ultimately, where do golf course superintendents bury this?
Well,
what I've seen is they'll put those in the...
Yeah, well,
you know,
well, here's what I can tell you, because, you know, I've actually had a conversation about these water sensors, even with Dana Lon from the Toro company. He was on the show back in the beginning of this year. We started with this conversation because I'm growing increasingly obsessed. I'm growing increasingly obsessed with getting as much data as we possibly can and beginning to learn what are the important pieces of data, because some things are just too easy to pass on. Ben, are you saying if I put these turf guard sensors in, which I think we put them in our sand base screens, I think we put them in about so that the top bars are about an inch and a half down and we know where they are. And so we do that in about five or six locations. And so that's the first thing. I wonder, first of all, before I, and just give me a quick answer on that. If I do everything right, and I get the data back, is that decent data, even though it's wireless moisture sensors?
Well, I don't think there's any problem with the data, and I think it's a great concept, but I think the spatial resolution that you're probably able to get those measurements at with a realistic budget for 18 greens may be out of reach for a lot of golf courses.
Oh, yeah, and that's another point. Okay, so perfect. So the data's good, but yes, can cost a lot. And then I'm going to even ask you one more question that's going to drive you crazier. If you think buying 18 of them is a lot, I don't even care about the putting greens because I think the handheld units can do a good job there. If you can put wireless sensors in low spots and high spots, that's good. But the fact is, Ben, you and I know the majority of water is used out in the fairway. The largest areas of the golf course is where the greatest water use is. So what I am arguing for, I guess, is just more precision in these larger areas and maybe sensors if strategically placed based on, you know, the USDA Web Soil Survey or something that said, here's the soil types across these fairways. And, well, if it's capped, it's a different deal. But, you know, here's the soil types. Put about, I would say 50, maybe 50. 50, you could probably get 50 for 10 grand. Would 50 be enough on 18 holes?
If you could get a sensor per head, I mean, you'd be in great shape. I think the direction things are going is fantastic. But part of the challenge is when I go to sod farms, I think they probably have the greatest irrigation efficiency I've seen, and some of these linear systems will allow variable output. And that could, in many respects, that can be driven off satellite imagery, et cetera. But so you have a very level system in that scenario. But you get on a golf course, as you say,
right.
You have so much undulation, you have so much in the way you have to get surface drainage. So it can become a challenge. And then, of course, sorting out those maps and understanding, is this an area that's this dry because of compaction, because of slope? It's not an easy answer.
No, and that's why, hey, we just tackled the tough questions here, Professor Worley. I don't know what other podcast you're doing. Maybe you're over there talking with Kaminsky and having some other conversation about water. But over here, we're talking about things that we are trying to wonder about moving forward. So listen, Ben, we're going to take another break right now. When we come back, I want to make sure we're ready to talk about, to go back up to 30,000 feet and say, okay, here's one thing superintendents should be thinking about. I want to talk about the interaction you're having with the policymakers and the water purveyors, because I think ultimately they're going to decide what we might have access to. When we come back, we'll be here with Professor Ben Worley from Texas A&M University. I'm Frank Rossi. This is Frankly Speaking on the TurfNet Radio Network.
It's a fact. UVB and infrared radiation are harmful to plant health and can actually damage a plant's ability to photosynthesize properly. Turf Screen is the only product independently verified to reduce the damaging effects of solar radiation and to significantly improve turf quality, density, and health. Decrease water usage, turf stress, and wilt. Increase chlorophyll and photosynthesis. Don't be fooled by ordinary dark pigments. Give your fine turf a leg up on summer stress with Turf Screen. For research data, application information, and to find your nearest distributor, visit turfscreen.com.
Welcome back to Frankly Speaking. I'm here with Professor Ben Worley of the Texas A&M University. In turf grass science and ecology, I love all the names they give us. We're all going to be called urban grassland specialists in our next iteration of turf grass professionals. When we left, Ben, we were talking about your role and what you're doing with water purveyors, and that was really the genesis of our conversation that got me interested in having you on. When you teach your seminar for the GCSAA to golf course superintendents, you talk about water budgeting and water purveyors and how those things are linked. Can you take a second and take us through those two concepts? First of all, what are water purveyors? What are they doing? And what should golf course superintendents be doing from a water budgeting perspective? Let's start with the purveyors.
Sure. Well, you know, in Texas, I don't want to say it's new to us, but certainly the issues with water are moving further and further eastward. You know, it's been a very common problem in the western U.S., and water's always been a challenge. But more and more as what we're seeing is areas even in the southeast, and especially areas where we see population growth, just a lot more competition nowadays for water. And the water purveyors are basically the agencies, almost governmental-like, that regulate and make decisions about who gets the water, in many cases how much that water costs. And to a large extent, at least in our part of the country, golf course superintendents have historically been a little more immune to these kind of issues. But right, more and more we're seeing a lot more of these purveyors kind of stepping in, and especially as we hit, drought or we're getting lower water supply.
So purveyor is a code word for what? Purveyor is generally a municipality, or can it be a private purveyor? When you use the word, you have to remember, as it moves east, one of the things us in the east have to learn is the vernacular or the jargon used in water stuff. So tell me what a water purveyor is. It's somebody who owns the water, or it's the government? Who is it, Ben?
That's a great question, Frank. I don't even know if I fully understand, to be honest with you, but just about every ounce of water, in Texas is controlled by some district, some water purveyor in a sense. So, for example,
it's a public entity? Is it a
throughway
authority or something?
That's right. So in San Antonio, you have the San Antonio Water System. They really make decisions regarding to all of the water users in San Antonio. And then some of the larger cities like Dallas have multiple purveyors that might be managing certain areas of the area in that part of the state. Ultimately, most golf courses, anybody that's using water will be having to deal with these agencies in some way or another. And what we've seen a trend towards in the last few years are purveyors starting to put pressure on golf courses and really cause them to justify water use and basically provide justification for the amount of water that's being allocated to them. And in the case of 11 and 12, when we had such a bad drought here in Texas, many courses suffered allocations midway through the year and 10, 15, 20% in the amount of water that they were able to use.
I want to go to the heart of this for a second, because this is important, I think, for people who don't live this. A lot of listeners don't, this is a lot of stuff they're not considering. But for sure, you said something about allocation. So somewhere, somebody sits down and says, you got 200 acres of golf course in Texas somewhere. Let's call it, we'll just call it blah, 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 Texas, right? And you have this kind of grass there and this kind of grass there based on this ET model will need this much water. And therefore, you know, based on normal climate data, here's your allocation. Is that what we're talking about? A simple somebody sits down on the back of a napkin and does this thing?
Well, I'd say we probably put a little more information to it, but it's not necessarily a new concept. It's been around for a while. If you look at some of the textbooks, you know, water budgeting isn't a new phenomenon, but you see in parts of the country where water there's a lot of pressure and scrutiny over water that budgets are very important. And
So you're saying I'm talking about it from the purveyor's end.
That's right. So in terms of whether you're building a new golf course, whether there's an increase in competition due to a growing community, that's what it becomes a justification for the water that you've been using. I've been to a number of courses where I say, how much water do you need on this course? And the question comes back, well, I don't really know how much I need. I can show you how much I've used the past 10 years. And that's probably not going to fly. That's probably not going to fly as we move forward. And that's really what we're trying to help superintendents in really getting a grasp on what they should be putting out there for the turf they're managing.
So I see what you're saying now. So in other words, what is pretty standard operating procedure in places now where water has any pressure, that superintendents are being challenged, and I would imagine as well developers are being challenged. If they want to put up another 20 house subdivision, that they figure out how many toilets are going to get flushed, right? That gets included in any purveyor's calculation as well. That's what you mean by population, right, Ben?
That's right. That's right. And so that became a big issue that superintendents in many parts of Texas hadn't even given much thought to, at least in eastern Texas. And we went through a very bad drought, really a drought of record. And it really forced superintendents to have to consider that and have to start to deal with these regulators. Reality.
Okay. And so what happened now is they're held accountable for how much water they need. The water's getting pressured. Now they're sort of onto this. So are you seeing a more deliberate attempt from some of the superintendents? Was it a one-year drought, Ben?
It stretched over about 2 to 3 years.
Did you see that response now that they had to justify their water use based on historical? Here's what I've been using. I'm assuming that the guys you're working with, that all these guys in these dry areas, are getting pretty good at justifying their water use, and that is the basis for why you're recommending and the GCSA is using this water budgeting tool that was the basis of the survey, right? That they went through the water use survey. So talk to us for a minute about, just in general terms, the concept of water budgeting on a golf course.
So yeah, water budgeting is very, not that much different than, budgeting in your own household, I mean, in economic terms. So, right. And the first thing a superintendent really needs to understand is get a good grasp of acreage on irrigated areas, take into account turf species, and then also get a appropriate coefficients. And this will ultimately get them to a water requirement for those areas, and it's really oftentimes based on historical data because you're planning for the future. So you may be looking, you may have access to, like we do in Texas, most of our major cities have at least 30 years of historical data, precipitation data and reference ET data that a superintendent could access for his location, could develop a month-by-month water requirement for the turf, and then essentially take into account a few other factors such as distribution uniformity, and you know perhaps rainfall and what we might consider to be effective rainfall, and of course there'd be some discrepancy between soils on that, but basically calculate that information up for the growing season and come out to a total gallons for the year, which you would use that total gallonage to really represent your water budget as you deal with the water permitters. And that information is again based on amount of water that you need under ideal growing conditions.
So,
and that's a good
starting point
for any superintendent.
That's exactly right. And that's of course where you get in trouble budgeting, and why generally when you go through budgeting, there sometimes can be, and there probably should be, a margin for error or some padding around numbers, because of the severe conditions you get in. But I guess, Ben, as I start to wrap this up, you know, I know you looked at Primo, I know you looked at traffic, I know you looked at mowing, and you've looked at grass types over the years. I want to ask two questions about technology. One question is, are we really capitalizing on existing technology? By that I mean, are we using the grasses we should be using? Are we managing them the way we should be managing them? Right? Are we using the grasses we should be using from a water conservation perspective for golf courses?
I think so. I mean, what I'll say there is that water is extremely important, but it's not everything. We can't disregard other functional characteristics and attributes of those turf species that we need to use. For high traffic situations, for shade, for dealing with salinity. So water can't be the be-all, end-all when we're selecting a grass, or else we're going to run into some problems. And so
are you seeing what we're seeing? One of the things I'm seeing from traveling the country, Ben, just let's talk about grasses. And I know you've looked at, you know, zoysias and Bermuda, so I know you can speak intelligently about this. But I wonder if what we're seeing isn't happening to you in some other way. We're seeing the normal grasses that we can grow out here. We've grown up here for the last 30 to 50 years and have improved the genetics on dramatically, not performing the way they have in the past because of the severe changes and dramatic changes in the climate over the last 5 to 10 years, you could probably argue if you looked at it. Are you seeing that with some of the traditional grasses that you're using in your climate, that they're getting challenged in ways they haven't been in the
past? For sure. I mean, and I think it's not necessarily water only, but it, you know, with many of these courses, they're having to use less water, but they're also using more salty water or sodium-laden water, so recycled water, for example. So what we're seeing is a shift towards grasses that need to be able to tolerate less water and maybe more salty water. And so we have good genetics coming down the pipeline right now, and I think you see, at least in our part of the country, you see a lot of superintendents moving away from the standard, tiffways, which is still a great performing grass, but perhaps moving to something different that might have a little better drought tolerance or might have a little better salinity tolerance.
And is that zoysia grass? Does zoysia grass fit that bill for a lot of people?
Well, that's an interesting question. And it really comes down to the response that you're going to see between the Bermudas and the zoysias. I would say not necessarily, Frank. I mean, I think the Bermudas are hard to beat when it comes to drought. Of course, the zoysias are extremely drought tolerant, but they like to go dormant when things get dry.
And what about salt tolerance too? I mean, I think sometimes Bermuda and Zoysia are a lot more salt tolerant than we thought, because I see them doing pretty well in some past balance stands.
Yeah, we've done some testing here and seen a few cultivars of Bermuda that can hang right in there with the past palums, and even in some of our greenhouse testing, we've got nearly ocean strength water that we're growing these things in. It's remarkable.
Yeah.
And as long as you don't pour a lot of heat in there, these number of these Bermudas will hang in there really nicely. So I think we're doing a good job with the species we're using. I see superintendents moving to some more adapted Bermuda grasses. But again, I think water's important, but there we have to take everything into consideration for our site and what are going to be those stresses that we're going to deal with.
Right. Okay. So one last question on technology, Ben, and then we're going to let you get on with your South Central Texas afternoon on a Friday afternoon as we're having this conversation. So again, back to technology. I'm imagining a world soon on a golf course, certainly in the next 3 to 5 to 7 years, could be for three for many. Add the real surge of technology to the golf course. I think GPS sprayers are going to be much more common than we see them there. Come into the marketplace, I think they're going to start to see more acceptance. And I'm big on sensor technology. I really like the idea of that real-time sensing. Can you imagine, or have you ever seen, where you could turn the keys of the fairway irrigation system off over to the soil moisture sensors with some calibration, right? I'm going to put soil moisture sensors in my fairways. Let's assume it's affordable. And let's assume I spent a season calibrating them to my eye, just like you do your handheld meters. Would you then feel comfortable, for the most part, at least turning a majority of the watering of the fairway turf, assuming, you know, situations that would allow that, over to the sensors? Could you imagine that?
Wow. I think that's the goal we've been going after for 15, 20, 30 years. I mean, that would be ideal. I think every superintendent would love that. I don't know what the cost would be, but I think in the future, if we could do whatever we wanted, yeah, I think we'd have a sensor that was positioned for every head on the course, with extreme precision in the way we're applying water. It would be very much like we're trying to do manually nowadays on greens with hand watering, where we're only putting it exactly where it's needed, and basically get away from a blanket application, certainly that's done on a, you know, one, just a calendar basis. And then and so, you know, ultimately everything comes back to soil moisture. You know, we're trying to maintain an ideal range of soil moisture in that system. Some areas are needing it more frequently or in different application scheduling than other areas. So I think what you see, I think you definitely see a lot of the big industry players moving that direction. I think certainly Toro's probably been a pioneer in that.
In general, right? They're also trying to do spectral stuff on the surface. I mean, remember years ago, maybe that even been when you started your graduate career. I mean, 10 years ago, every paper at C5 was a Toro-funded remote sensing variable rates thing. So, again, that technology, sure, all that stuff is there. And so I think when we can get people who understand the basis of sort of plants and water use like you do, the impact of management, the idea of water budgeting, if we can throw that technological piece and superintendents get continually comfortable with managing data to help them make a decision, still making the decision, leaving the decision,
sure,
in the hand of the superintendent for the variety of reasons you and I know we still call the art of managing a golf course, right? So, you know,
sure,
never taking it out, but you can see that piece fitting in soon, can't you?
Sure, absolutely. I think that's the way it's got to go. I mean, we don't have a choice.
Yeah,
water's
right.
Precious, and it's going to either we get better with the way we manage it, or we're going to be out of business. So,
okay, and there is your last word, my friend, Professor Worley. Ben Worley, Texas A&M University, thank you for joining me where it's smart talk from leading thinkers and always Frankly Speaking.
You have been listening to Frankly Speaking with host Dr. Frank Rossi on TurfNet Radio Network. Check back for schedules on future programs. Thanks for tuning in.